This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stasio. In the summer of 2001 in New York City, the temperature is rising. It's getting hot, sweltering hot, so hot that radios reported the weather out of habit. Sleeping couples woke up to damp sheets. Construction workers went without shirts, and stockbrokers loosened their ties with envy. Thus begins the new novel, Burning City, by Ariel and Joaquin Dorfman. The heat portends a literal explosion that will come in September, and several internal explosions happening to the book's protagonist, Heller Highland. Ariel Dorfman is professor of literature and Latin American studies at Duke University and lives in Durham. And Joaquin Dorfman, a recent refugee from Brooklyn, is also in Durham these days before he moves on to his next adventure. And we welcome you both to the studio.
Thank you. It's a great pleasure to be here again, Frank.
And also we welcome your calls, 877-962-9862. To talk to Ariel and Joaquin Dorfman about their new book or about the enterprise of working together, father and son, on any project, but anything as intimate and personal as a book, I have to ask you both, who did the typing?
Do we reveal the secret, Joaquin?
I don't see why not. This no one can moment. See whether or not we're lying.
Okay, you should begin then.
Oh, well, if that's what you meant by reveal, then actually probably shouldn't. You can go ahead first this time.
Okay, let's just say, let me begin with the origins of this, okay, how it began. Because we had already been collaborating with Joaquin on a screenplay when he was in junior high, I think, right? Jake, it was around?
I think so, 15, yeah.
Yeah, he was on 15, 16. We started working together because I had been working with his brother, Rodrigo, with whom I had already written a couple of plays and screenplays and things like that. And Joaquin was saying, well, when? So we had already had an experience of working together.
And this would have been about 10 years ago, 15, 16,
around,
26?
Around 10 years ago. That's when we started working together because he kept on saying, well, when are we going to work together? And I said, well, let's do this together. We worked on it for a long time. And so at some point, having done that, they in New York, a friend of ours was organizing a television series with a series of writers. It was Paul Auster and Salman Rushdie and Peter Carey and Joyce Carol Oates. Somebody really, you know, and it was called Kids in New York. And they said, would you like to do it? And I said, yes, I would, but, you know, I'd like to do it with a real young man. And by then, Joaquin was already at NYU. He was in New York. I said, I have a kid who's in New York. You know, he's barely out of adolescence, but I'd like to work with him because we know how to work together. And we came up with the basis of this story. And it was going to be for Showtime, and then Showtime decided that they didn't want to do that. They took our story and wanted to make it a two-hour film. And so we had a treatment and the beginning of a screenplay. And then one day I was in England on another thing. I had a children's story. And my editors there said, have you ever done a young adult book? Mm. And I said, you know what? We have one. We? What do you mean we? I mean, well, my son and I have. And if you don't mind us doing it, we passed it to them. And they said, yes, we love this story. Write it. So we came up with a way in which we would write it. That's the origin of it. So we had already worked out the territory in the sense that we're not territorial, but that we can work together in that sense. And then we came up with the way in which we began to work on this, knowing what the story was about already, which helps in the sense, you know, that we already agreed on that. And maybe, Joaquin, you want to take over and just explain how the typing went.
Well, the typing basically was helped along by the fact that we didn't actually sit in a room together typing, choosing sentences. First of all, we have very different schedules, the two of us. Mm-hmm. I suppose Ariel has more of the Ernest Hemingway, wake up in the morning regiment, whereas I have more of the Charles Bukowski, sit down at 8 p.m. and then write through the night. Mm-hmm. However, I oftentimes did the drinking for both of those icons.
Absolutely.
Over the course of this.
I drank enough water, I see. But Joaquin was sort
exactly.
of...
Exactly. So
limit
he was
the effects
he was,
of the hangover.
He was my sobriety, basically. through osmosis and diffusion, we took care of all that.
I am your sobriety. I like that.
Well, now, when it comes to... So did one of you pick a chapter? I'll write chapters. I'll write the even chapters. You write the odd ones? Or how'd it go?
We were going to do that with nouns and verbs. didn't work
adjectives
out.
And adverbs as well.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Not to mention vowels and consonants. didn't work out quite that way.
No, you have to have somebody in the typist seat, let's say, really... giving an imprimatur, in other words, giving that, and that was Joaquin.
Now, the book is, let's talk a little bit about the story, because you've got essentially a 16-year-old bicycle messenger touring. So what we're able to do is really get a tour of New York. We're able to see the city in parts of the city that no one ever sees. But we're also able to watch a young man come of age. And so those two things happen in this book. But it's and we're set in New York City the summer before 9/11. So let's start with that particular decision, that plot decision. Why then? Why that time and that place?
Well, we had already decided. In other words, we had written this out before September 11th, 2001. We had the story. We had the story of a kid in New York. And however, when we wrote it, it was written after September 11th. And so there were some people who were saying, oh, you know what? You should do it after 9/11, right? And that's what makes it's so easy to work with Joaquin. We both, 100% instinctively said no. In fact, this story is a great prelude to something tremendous that is about to happen where you have the dread in the air. You have the possibility of that. And it's also about, but we'll talk about that later. It's about the fact that this is a city that seems to be in perfect shape, and except that it's melting, you know, from the heat. But the bad news keeps on coming into this city.
The bad news.
And the bad news is, the real bad news is going to come to this city, but people don't realize it. So there's a young man who is an expert in bad news, who's touring this city, who's got it. And then on the horizon, you can see that. And we thought everybody who reads this book is going to think that it's going to end with September 11th, 2001. And we wanted to frustrate that. We didn't want people to think, that's the answer to it, of course. Yeah. But, in a sense, we're giving away the ending. The fact that there is no 9/11.
It doesn't end with 9/11?
I cut out the last chapter, Joaquin. I cut it out.
Well, I'm talking with Ariel and Joaquin Dorfman, whose new book is Burning City. It is described as young adult fiction. It was a joint project. To give us a sense of that sense of foreboding, the sense of the city before 9/11, even though the idea was, you concocted it before that, read for a passage, if you would, that gives us a sense of that. Here on the bottom of page 30.
All right. I'm starting with a paragraph.
This is Joaquin, yeah. A word? A world?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
A world of noise at his back. Heller exploded out into the park, past the arch and back onto Waverly Place. He left them all behind to love him, hate him, speak of him for days to come. Riding his bike and tearing through the concrete streets and alleyways of the city, this was where Heller felt close to the world. Through red lights and one-way streets, ignoring the sun, the sweat, polar ice caps, slaughter overseas, lost votes, Air Jordan's AIDS, and that slow countdown that everyone felt in the back of their heads, throats, hearts. The entire world was going to melt that summer, and it was in those moments that Heller was more than willing to melt right with it, right on schedule.
Yeah, this is really a portent of what's to come, but a pretty good description of a hot city and a young man whose job is, by the way, to deliver messages, and he's an expert in delivering the bad news.
Absolutely. Well, we came up with the idea of Soft Tidings.
Name of the company, right?
The name of the company.
Yeah. Which was definitely, if you were to take a look at my non-published work and his published work, is definitely more his baby, definitely, than mine, simply because it is one of those very strange ideas that somehow would not quite work in the real world. It could. It's possible, but it's got a certain quirkiness to it. And if you were to examine it very closely, you might start saying, well, maybe this wouldn't work like this or this, but how did they do this with the messages? And it actually, I think, added very much to what this eventually became, which is basically a bit of a fable.
Right.
There is a certain lack of reality, and not to say that that's not what New York is like. In fact, New York is a very surreal city where oftentimes people will say, I can't believe that happened. Anybody who lives there will say, well, stands to reason. Of course that happened. Of course it happened here in New York, sort of the crux of the entire world almost.
Yeah. When I read that in the promotional material, the multicultural fable, and then I read the book and I said, well, but that is New York.
It is New York, exactly.
New York is a multicultural fable.
I mean, it is that's why it's so terrible that there were terrorist attacks against it, in many senses, in the sense that it was an attack on the idea of a city where, I was brought up in that city as a little Argentinian kid. Joaquin went there as a Chilean born in Amsterdam. I mean, we're just an example of people coming to that city. And anything can happen there. But what matters is that because everybody's come to that city, and because life has become so impersonal, the owner of Soft Tidings has decided to create a company where people will deliver the messages personally. You know, like they used to deliver a birthday greeting or something like that. So if good things happen to you, which most of the kids there are delivering good messages, or terrible things are happening, it's given to these messengers to go And Heller's the only one with a bike, and he rushes around the city in a frenzy, hectically, to deliver these messages. But he's delivering messages from the world outside, that third world, which is, in fact, impinging on the United States. You know, it's a story of immigrants coming to America. But when they come, they leave behind all these tragedies or all these weddings or these baptisms or these wonderful things that happen, right? Or somebody, you know, getting released from jail or things like that. So all these stories are coming into New York, these wonderful stories or terrible stories. And Heller is a specialist in delivering bad news. That's his specialty.
And it's all coming in. And there's just a lot of high technology. As you say, these are stories coming in via the internet.
Right.
And making connection to an impersonal world. And Heller, and we'll get into this a little more after the break, is somebody who, on the outside, when he's getting there, going from place to place, man, you feel the danger of that city and the raw impersonality
Absolutely.
Of it. Once that apartment door closes, he becomes another person. There's an intimacy that I want to talk about after the break. This is The State of Things. We're talking today about Burning City, a new young adult novel by Ariel and Joaquin Dorfman. They're with us in the studio. We're taking your calls at 877-962-9862. Support for The State of Things comes from listeners who support North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. Durham's own Ariel and Joaquin Dorfman are with us today. We're talking about their new novel, Burning City. It's the story of 16-year-old Heller Hyland and his summer of delivering bad news in New York City. Also taking your calls, are you? What is your favorite coming-of-age story that you read as a young person? If you're a parent, are there stories that you'd like your kids to read? Are you having a hard time getting your kids, young people, to read? Young adult fiction is now a burgeoning column. It's an area in the bookstore now. What are you reading these days? Do you wish that your kids were reading more? What stories were great for you? 877-962-9862. Ariel and Joaquin Dorfman will be at Quail Ridge Books tonight signing books. They'll be there at 7 o'clock. And, of course, if you're listening at 9 o'clock, you've already missed it. But if you're listening now live or if you're listening at 4 o'clock, how confusing is that? Quail Ridge Books, 7 p.m. tonight. And 877-962-9862 is the number to call if you want to join our conversation. So before the break, we're talking about the cinematic quality of the book itself, the story, because when Heller's on the streets, I'm hearing doors slam and he's grabbing onto cabs and going for joyrides and doing all kinds of dangerous things, but he has a kind of an extra natural sensitivity when he closes the apartment door and is one-on-one with somebody.
I think that's so right, Frank. I mean, one of the interesting things about Heller was we wanted to create a creature who was like so many adolescents, like so many adults as well. A double. In other words, he had a double life in the sense that he's a madman on wheels, and he can do anything and is sure of himself and has this sense of place and time and energy, and he's perfect, right, in that sense, you know, and everybody loves him or hates him in that sense. But as soon as he gets off that bike, in one sense, he becomes a sensitive, very comforting person. That's why he's so good at delivering bad news, because he's able to absorb like a sponge. He knows exactly what to say, right? But he's also very, very shy, and especially with girls, you know. So he's a typical adolescent in that sense, that he goes from highs to lows constantly.
But at the same time, I think that he also very much reflects what New York is all about, in the sense that if you ever have anybody who says shy of moving to New York because they don't like the crowds, they are generally a very quiet person, they like intimacy, I would say that the interesting thing about New York, and it is reflected in, I would say, the schizophrenia that you find in Heller, is that you can go to New York and make it yours. It's a city that is both intimate and chaotic and open at the same time. If you walk down the streets in New York, you will see people, say lovers in the street having a spat, an argument, breaking up, you'll have people fighting. For them, they're in their own little bubble right now because they're aware that people will look at them, but the city's going to keep moving. Whereas you, as the outsider, say, my goodness, how can they be doing this in the middle of the street? Kind of like, how can light be straight and curved at the same time? There is something of a paradox in New York that I think is embodied in the main character of Burning City.
There's a way to find your own privacy in a place like New York, but the compassion that he shows, and Joaquin, I want to address this question to you first. You know, one of the things that us old folks worry about is that, particularly with so much mediated experience with all, you know, the television and movies and the way young folks are experiencing the world, mm-hmm. not firsthand, that the idea of compassion and the ability to be compassionate may be sort of leaking out of the gene pool. This guy, Heller, has that ability. Are you worried? Do you feel that this is something being lost in folks in your generation, or is it? Are we just not recognizing it?
I've thought about it before several times, and I think that I'm not entirely sure how things were when you all were kids. I've always felt that sometimes, yes, there are certain trends and habits as the world evolves, as people evolve, as things become more modern, as we lose certain, say, values from the past that may or may not have been there. A lot of people say, well, when we were young, nothing like this, this, and this happened. But yes, quite a few things happened. Parents did booze it up in cars. They did go to the back seats with their girlfriends. So sometimes there are illusions that we're told about that were never quite there. So I'm not entirely sure whether perhaps things, the feeling of compassion might not have always been sort of the same. You've got people who lose it along the way. You've got people who gain it. I do definitely think that while there is a lot to be said for seeing the world basically secondhand through television, through movies, but also at the same time through books and through other media that also teaches, you can learn many things from a book, but nothing substitutes for firsthand experience. And I would also say that the problem is not necessarily media and TV. The problem is that isn't that we have too much violence in the media, too much violence on TV, too many stories in the newspaper that only focus on people stabbing each other in the throat. I think it's more that we need to accept that that's there and focus more on a counterbalance rather than fighting what we believe to be the problem.
You know, I just wanted to add that Heller is very compassionate, and he goes around comforting and consoling people, knows just what to say, and yet the book is about the fact that this compassion of his is all towards strangers, and that the book is really about the fact that what happens when the tragedies come home to roost, what happens when the bad news that he's delivering really affect him, right? So it's almost like you're somebody who's taking care of these people who are in a hospital, right? And then all of a sudden your mother comes in with a cardiac arrest. It's different, right? So he's going to go through the process of understanding that that this compassion of his has only gone so far. He's going to have to discover that some stories that he's going to tell and certain tragedies that he's going to bring to other people have to do with him. And that has to do with growing up. So I would say the same thing is very similar to what's going to happen to many of the young people. They may feel they're not compassionate. I believe compassion, by the way, is I think we're genetically wired for evolution to be compassionate towards one another. I think that's what we are. I think solidarity is not something, you know, invented by somebody. It's something that's how we survived that's how we walked out of Africa, basically. I think otherwise we wouldn't have been able to do it. But I think that we have become deadened and dulled in that sense. Now, what happens is that every adolescent out there who thinks that the television or the video games are going to save him or her from ever having to face real, tremendous problems is wrong. And Heller also thinks in some sense that he can shield himself. And what I like about the book, about how we wrote it, is how very slowly we're going into this kid. We see that compassion, then we realize with him that he's got a long ways to go, that's not enough. It's a substitute, really, for his not engaging in the world. He's so shy.
Ariel Dorfman and his son Joaquin are with me today talking about their new book, Burning City. 877-962-9862 is the number to call if you'd like to join the conversation. Amy is on the line from Chapel Hill. Hi, Amy. You have a question?
Yeah, I was interested in the name of Heller Highland, and I want to just find out about how you guys got that name. I mean, whether Heller comes from Joseph Heller or, you know, I also see there's like above and below Hell and Highland and embodied in that name. Anyway, I'd love to hear some comments on that.
Okay, Amy, thank you.
Thank you.
We can't agree on who should answer this. This is Ariel.
Heller? So instead, let me tell you what I had for dinner last night.
No. Heller, in fact, we got it from Joseph Heller, right? And then Joaquin sees no meaning to names, whereas I puzzle over them constantly, all over and over again. So I'll make an analysis, which is exactly what you say, which is hell and high water, hell and land, right? I mean, all these things. But the idea is he's on a bike. He's going for it, you know?
And
whereas I think things just need to sound very, very good. Basically, for me, it's purely structural. I basically, after we got through this project, people started asking us questions about the book, about the context, about the meaning. Only then did any of it actually come to me. During the process of writing, I don't think about those things if I can possibly help it. It's, for me, it's pure craft whenever possible.
Which is great, because then what he does is he's writing it, and then I'm analyzing it. I'm reading it. I'm working. I'm editing. I'm rewriting. I'm doing rewrites. And I'm thinking always about these, not when I'm writing, but I'm always thinking about this general structure of things. So I mean, I'm thinking, oh, Heller, yeah, this is great, because it gives the idea of but the messenger is very important, Jake. The idea of him as a messenger. And that has to do with Heller and Highland and all that.
That's true. However, I do insist that I wasn't really thinking about the meaning. when I was working through those parts, I wasn't really thinking about it. I just sort of said, well, here's something I learned about the messengers between heaven and earth. I'll kind of put that in and see what happens. And it just seems to always fit.
Well, who actually came up with the name?
I think probably it was more me than Joaquin. I tend to work with that.
Was there any point in the process when, for instance, you came up, you sort of had an analysis and say, this is going to work great, because I know that later on in the book, when that name pops up, there's going to be a moment that we've written that it's going to be perfect. You know, your experience would tell you that. And Joaquin, you say, it doesn't feel right. It doesn't. So now you talk to, now you talk it over. You say, well, okay, the name of, Grifter isn't going to work, but come up with something else, Dad, that meets your analytical criteria but sounds better. Were there compromises like that where you said, you know, here's the analysis. It should be this. Yeah, Dad, but that one didn't work. Come up with a new one.
That actually happened, I think, more with going over the chapters that were written and discussion of the plot with the names. Generally, the first names we came up with would be random. Mm. Some names I would choose because of sometimes inside jokes, people that we've met in the past that certain characters remind us of. For example, I do like alliteration, but I don't always like it in names. I thought it was fine with Heller Highland. I thought that actually sounded good, but sometimes it doesn't always work. So the analysis of the names basically starts within his head, and he says it, and then whether or not it sounds good, I'll agree with it. But he rarely uses actual analysis of names to win that particular argument.
Absolutely. No, what does matter, Frank, is that we have a theory about how you write. Both of us agree on this, which is that if you've defined the voice right, if you know who the characters are and you know what they want to do, you don't have to decide anything except that. You have to let the character show you the way. And that's why, I mean, we ourselves didn't quite know how this was all going to end up. And that's what I think gives a thrill to the writing, because if you're not interested in finding out, I mean, I always write because I want to find out what's going to happen. I'm interested in figuring this out, in writing it out. And I know that Joaquin does the same thing. Now, once in a while, what you suggested is exactly what happens, which is Joaquin tells me, I did this, and I say, I think this is a mistake. And he'll say, why? And I say, well, you know, you'll find out in 5 chapters. And I may be right, and he may be right, you know? And there's a moment, which I think may be helped by the fact of father and son, because of the love we have for one another and the respect we have for one another, where we sort of say, I notice something in his voice, or he noticed something in mine, when we really, really are, really want to, you know, fight that. We say, this is something that I don't want to compromise on, you know? And there's always a moment when one of us backs down and says, okay, let's wait. Because there's always, I mean, you know, why do you, you don't have to go into the battle right away. You say, okay, look, I'll give you that. I'll concede that. Let's see if I'm right or if you're right. And let's revisit it, you know. And there are a couple of places where, things remain in here, which I still don't agree with, you know. And there are things that Joaquin as well.
For example, I wanted zombies and aliens at one point. And he insisted that it didn't fit and I should wait for
another
book
aliens.
To do that.
Only illegal aliens.
I mean, are you serious about that? You did want them?
Oh, I mean, there were moments where I got frustrated and I thought, okay, we can solve this scene by adding a zombie. That's the best way to solve anything. And it just, you know. Also, I wanted the main character's name to be Bikey McBikemobile. But he shot that down too, and I'm glad he did.
Well, right. The last line here, and when they, but they woke up and it was all a dream. Now, who's that? No, I'm just kidding. There's another complication in all this. You talked about, you know, sort of letting the voice tell you what the story is and being faithful to the voice, but you've got the complication of writing young adult fiction. So now this thing has to appeal to young adults. How did that go? Did you find yourself stopping at any point and saying, wait a minute, no 14-year-old boy is going to get this?
Anytime he said anything, I would tell him. Anytime I said anything, it was, of course, you know, pure unadulterated youthfulness and sprightliness.
You know, we do not write down to a 14-year-old. We write up to a 14-year-old. In other words, we think that the 14-year-old, like Heller himself, who's 16, knows a lot about the world. There's no paternalism in this just because it happens to be an older man like myself, and Joaquin was now 26, but he was 22, 23 when he began this. We think that they have a great deal of wisdom, and we think, in fact, that they are growing up in a world where they know lots of things. So I certainly never thought that we were writing anything but something that young adults would like, but that adults would adore as well. And in fact, you know, it's already been compared to Holden Caulfield, a multicultural Holden Caulfield, which I think is a very good way of explaining that. Instead of being in Central Park, he's down in the village, in the gritty village, you know. And instead of catching people, young children in the rye, he's sending out messages about the children who are dying elsewhere. So, I mean, this is, but it's very much, help me, Joaquin.
It's very much me helping him at this moment, trying to think of what he was going to say, which is actually what I can add to that is that
this is how we work.
Especially when it comes to style and theme, I don't think there's anything better than a book that someone can go back to 2 years from now, 3 years from now, 4 years. I mean, I look back at some of the crap that I read when I was 14 years old, like, you know, certain, like, sort of, I guess, trashy, pulpy horror mm-hmm. stories. I look back at them and I was like, well, this doesn't do it for me anymore. It's kind of nice to have a story that you can look back either with fondness and perhaps you notice some things that were wrong, but it's still a story that is engaging and written in a style that you enjoy.
What are some of those stories for you? Well, while you're thinking about that, let me ask you another question. There's the whole question about whether or not young adults in the young adult fiction category are reading that way. This is a story with a lot of layers, a lot of complexity. It certainly moves. It's got a cinematic quality that I think any young person would appreciate. But have we sort of lost the ability to read? Are young folks as interested in books, particularly books that have the kind of layers that this does? Will they pick it up and stay with it?
I am hoping they will. Oh, God, I'm hoping they will. I actually don't know that much. I basically don't have much contact with 14-year-olds, 15-year-olds at this point. Whenever I do, generally, I see them walking around with a book, whether or not it's Harry Potter, whether or not it's mine. My father and I have the same philosophy that basically anything that you read is good.
I mean, my theory about literature in general and writing in general is, look, here's a great story. You have a kid on wheels delivering terrible messages. He has a mentor who is a Turkish illegal immigrant who's an incredibly wise man who's going to get into trouble and who's going to try to save him in some ways. And he falls in love with a girl a little bit older and a little bit more experienced. Don't tell me that kids, young people, cannot understand what this is about. Now, what happens in any piece of literature, anyone, is that there are layers and layers and layers. So what the more that you have as an experience, the deeper you are as a human being, the more you will get out of this, right? I mean, so there's enough in here for anybody to read. I defy anybody to say that they can't read it, because I think they can. Everybody can read it. Now, will everybody get everything out of it? I still haven't got everything out of it, you know, in the sense of it's a very rich, very dense book, but it's also a very easy read. Everybody's told me that they just read the book through and one sitting, they haven't been able to put it down. That's what you need. You know, you need to engage young people in that sense. And I think really, you know, I'm not saying buy this book because you're going to, I'm saying buy this book because you are going to love this. I mean, there's enough in here for anybody to understand it. And especially for young and old to understand it. I'd love a young person to grab this book and then say to his father or his mother, you got to read this. Because this is about us.
Certainly is a motif that's common to many of the coming-of-age, all of the coming-of-age stories, really the great ones. The idea that this Heller is, in effect, an orphan. He's living with his grandparents. His parents are far away. Was that something you did consciously?
Yes.
I think so. It's been a while since we did this, so...
Definitely. No, we wanted him not to... I mean, all the great mythic stories are the stories of the orphan who comes of age and who doesn't have a role model immediately in front of him, right, or her, in that sense. I think it's also for girls in that sense, but they don't have a mother and a father who will indicate to them what to do. So there's always that break in the origin, which is a mythic tale, right? In the case of Heller, we very much wanted his parents to be do-gooders. like I am in some sense. You know, I'm a human rights activist, etc. But with the idea that they're out saving the world in Africa, they're doing all the wonderful things that, that a lot of people like Amnesty International people do, right? Or they're working against AIDS in the third world, all these things. But we've noticed, because we noticed that, that they don't have time very often for their own kids who are back home, right? So they're out saving the world. Who's going to save Heller? The community around him, and basically he's going to have to do it on his own. He's going to have to find the mentor. He's going to have to find the girl. He's on a cell phone with his parents, but he doesn't know. He's on his own, and that's a great. It's also a very dramatic situation. It creates great suspense.
We are talking about Reading, Writing, and the Summer of 2001 with Ariel and Joaquin Dorfman, and we're taking your phone calls just ahead. 877-962-9862 on the state of things. Stay with us. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. We are talking this hour about Burning City. It's a new novel from father and son writing team Ariel and Joaquin Dorfman. They're with us in the studio today, and we're taking your phone calls at 877-962-9862. You know, we talked about the sort of the two different tones, what's going on in this book. When Heller is outside, it's moving and it's fast. And that certainly is very appealing and has a very cinematic quality. I was surprised to hear you say, Joaquin, that the parts of the book that were more you were the more meditative sections of the book.
I actually, in case anyone hasn't noticed, have far less energy somehow than this older version of me. I don't know quite how it happened. My father is very frenetic. He always has to be doing things. Like I said, he gets up at the crack of dawn, not because he necessarily wants to, but because the instant he wakes up, he feels he has to be doing something. I enjoy staring at walls, sitting in places for a long time, and honestly not doing much. I don't even really need a book in front of me or to be doing anything, though I do like crosswords. But for the most part, it's I'm more slothful in that respect. I like to take things easy, and I suppose that's why the more meditative parts, the slower parts, kind of are closer to me and sort of how I would feel walking around New York in the first place.
Well, let's hear an example, an All excerpt right. from Burning City.
Sundown. Heller sat on the steps of the gazebo, looking out past an expanse of lawn over the waterfront, New Jersey on the other side. Behind him, the Battery Park City apartments rose above it all, some of the most sought-after real estate in Manhattan. Loafers on the grass lay about under the red dish curtain of the day, waiting for the night to call them all home. Joggers, relaxed couples pushing strollers, kids chasing shadows, parents in slacks and sneakers, the nearby commotion of a friendly basketball game, all reflected in the Hudson River.
It's really a vision, a picture of a New York City that we're not particularly familiar with.
I was as surprised as anyone could be when I stumbled upon it, yes.
But it's related also to the fact, you know, that tragedies happen in the midst of good things. You know, the world is full of terrible things that happen, but it also happens in the middle of you're eating a bagel or you're watching a couple kiss on the grass or kids go by in roller skates. And I think that I believe we wanted to give some sense of that, you know. It's a book which has to do with tragedies, but it's not a bleak book at all. It's a book full of joy and strength and vitality in that sense, and meditation, you know, that he needs quiet moments because he's trying to figure out what it means to grow up, what it means to be an adult, what it means to internalize those things. Now, think that here you have a kid just before 9/11, and America is about to wake up to the fact that there's a world out there full of tragedy and it's going to come home. It's about to crash into the space that he's inhabiting right then, right? So in some sense, Heller is just anticipating the sort of work, the emotional work that needs to be done by everybody in the United States in as much as it has to do with how they relate to the outer world, how the global becomes, we've been global for a long time, you know. People keep on coming here. And I love the way in which Joaquin has woven this in and out, you know. And in fact, I had very often to force him into the more frenetic moods because he didn't want us to. He wanted to start with meditation on the 4th of July. And I keep on saying, no, Joaquin, get him on that bike. He's got to burst onto the scene because you have to start it with that energy, you know. And I was right about that, but he was right about how he wrote it.
Well, and that's the tension in the whole book, I guess, as you suggest, is his wanting to be. And the only place he can process a lot of this stuff is in those more meditative spaces. So,
or if he goes to see his girlfriend. I mean, he was not his girlfriend. He's lying about her, you know, that he sits and he...
There's also the theme, too, of the sense of perspective. And again, where better than New York to take a look at this? There's the telegram. There's the message to Sam Meyer, you know, who gets the bad news. And Heller tries to, you know, sort of make him feel better by showing him, hey, you know, you're not the only one going through all this. And he says it's a man. Meyer's wondering, what's this all about?
Well, we want an American. And Joaquin is, we have a Chinese woman, we have a Nigerian, we have an Albanian. We've got lots of different people who are all with bad news. And then we thought, well, let's work on something. And Joaquin worked on this scene a lot.
And once again, it's a bit more of the testament to what intuition was given to us as opposed to what it ended up being, whereas Ariel simply said, you know something, we probably need a scene with an American. And he didn't actually explain why it was necessary. It was at first just for contrast, to show that, yes, he does deliver inner city messages to people who have their own tragedies. As the scene went on and was written, it not only became a contrast in terms of the fact that an American is losing his job, not just losing his job, but claiming that he's lost his job to immigrants that Heller's delivering messages to, thus tightening the web, but also the fact that you can't always get upset at people for closing their eyes to what's going on around them, because the truth is, honestly, you sometimes do not have time to do it. I think when he says, I don't have time for perspective, I think that's a double-edged sword. I think you can always find time, perhaps, to think about things, but the truth is, when you've got kids who you have to feed, send off to school, buy them clothes, you have to worry about electric bills, it is very, very, very hard to think about things outside of your own problems. I don't actually blame anybody for taking that avenue of thought, honestly.
But that's what Heller does. Heller gives people time when they've had a tragedy to think a bit about it, in other words, to work on it. And I think, you know, it's strange, Joaquin, but I think that's what the book does as well. What the book does, what any book does, but this book in particular does, is you open it and you have time with these. I mean, the wonderful books that I've always read are the ones where I recognize that I have not, that these are problems I have, but I haven't figured them out. And this book is helping me just to situate them in a fictitious landscape so that I can work on them, you know, so that I can relate to them. And I think that the book does a bit with the reader what Heller does with his characters, with the people that he meets. Once again, this is a typical example of my analyzing something after we've done it, because I hadn't thought about this at all, but just listening to Joaquin, I thought, oh, that's what we've been doing, you know?
Well, how has the process changed you? How has the process given you, Joaquin, time? I mean, it's a book about coming of age at a time when you're just maybe a little beyond that. How much did you change and grow as a result of just doing this book?
I'm actually myself not entirely sure. My father thinks I have. I just finished I finished writing a second book for Random House, which will be coming out in the States, I believe, June of next year.
Yeah, next year.
Solo project. And according to Ariel, without this book beforehand, the other book might not have been possible. They're all sort of building blocks as you grow and expand. However, I prefer not to think about how I've grown and expanded, because once again, I don't want that interfering with just sort of the Zen act of just sitting down and going for it. I don't want to know how I've grown or analyze it as it's happening.
No, but I can tell you how he's grown just from the literary point of view. I won't speak about what this meant from the point of view of, because every act of literature is also an act of understanding in that sense. This was the first time that Joaquin had to figure out what I call trajectory. What I mean by that is, you know, you've got a character, and the character's static, and he's just repeating over and over again, or she's repeating over and over again, the same act, it's not very interesting. And what I found amazing is that for the first time, he really had to figure out how one act leads to the other. It's the most difficult thing to do as a writer, and to do it on a first novel. Now, I was there because I had figured out, in some sense, I have the experience. I've done it in four or five novels of my own. But Joaquin hadn't gone through that process. Now, that is something you can't teach anybody. You can't teach it in a writing course. You can't teach it by reading 500 books. You've got it or you don't have it. But you don't have it if you haven't got the capacity for developing it, in the sense that discovering that what you've written in chapter 4 will pay off in chapter 24 is something that is instinctive, that Zen thing that he's got. But if you haven't done it before, the next book, you have to do it. In other words, unless you've done it, you're never going to write a very interesting book. And I think that that's what I liked most about what was being done in this book. And I myself, you know, very often, I rarely myself write books that are very realistic. My books tend to be much quirkier than this in that sense. They're full of fantasies, you know, like kids who don't want to be born and go on strike inside the womb of their mother. That's not here, you know. So I think that Joaquin found that, and that's what makes a great read, where you know that you're being guided by somebody who is a master at the craft, and I think Joaquin learned how to be a master in this book.
So on the one hand, being guided by a master is a great thing for a young writer. On the other hand, being guided by your father, who already has a reputation, how are you concerned about being able to develop your own reputation and your own style after having written the book together, jointly?
Well, at the time, and in general, I don't really think about that simply because it's not as though I wake up in the morning, go to his office and say, hey, you wrote Death and the Maiden, can I have your autograph? Because then I'd have a lot of signed copies of Death and the Maiden and nobody needs that. However,
Thanks.
nice guy. You're walking home.
Well, I'm not paying for them. He's giving them to me, so I'm not really helping the family fortune. However, we did run across several times when we were touring over in Europe, we did run across several instances where you overhear people saying that I had nothing to do with the book, the whole coattail story, which is all very well and good. I found the best thing to do is to honestly not care. In fact, I have to look at myself and say, you know, something, any situation that involves a well-known father in any area with, say, an apprentice son, I would find myself being cynical as well, probably, and saying, you know what, I have to wonder, did this person really write this? And that's perfectly fine with me. And also, I don't really have to worry about separating myself stylistically or thematically because we are two different people with very different views, specifically on ideas of art and writing as well.
It gets me more angry, Frank, than it gets Joaquin, you know, in the sense because I know how this is. In other words, if we say, I mean, how was this book written? We say in Spanish, a cuatro manos, meaning, you know, when four hands are writing, playing the piano. I would say this is, he put three hands and I put one hand in it, you know, so I know exactly what I did in that sense, you know. But now my answer to anybody who has any doubts is, you just read the second novel they wrote solo and you tell me it didn't help to write this, he wasn't the main writer on this, and you'll know that you're wrong. So I mean, I think the fact that now he's gone ahead and written the second novel, and he's got a third one working on that, he's working on an adult novel. I think there's no doubt, you know, that we're in the presence of a very stellar and very brilliant literary talent.
Joaquin, had you always wanted to be mid sip? Had you always wanted to be a writer?
No, for a couple of dark years, I wanted to be in film. I actually went to Tisch for around...
At NYU.
Technically 2 years, though. I started dropping out of classes right about a year and a half. And that was a very unfortunate period of my life.
What made you... what attracted you to film and what repulsed you?
I've always loved movies. I just didn't realize that I loved watching them. The whole idea of being part of the film industry really was part of this young need to be famous and well-known and be part of the limelight and all that other stuff. After moving to New York shortly thereafter, I realized that if you are famous, well-known, in the limelight, you can never have any of the experiences that I ended up having in New York on your own as an anonymous person in a city of millions. So truth be told, it just was something that stopped appealing to me. And a lot of people say, when people ask me, why did you drop out of film school, I generally tell them because I was worried I might be successful.
Well, now, you told us something interesting just before the interview began. You've done a lot of radio interviews and a few TV, and you don't like doing TV at all. I mean, doing at least TV interviews. Is it something about the industry or something about having to go to makeup before you do the interview?
It's somehow a bit less natural. I mean, granted, right now we are working on equipment that was invented by some brilliant minds, and I'm not going to deny that this is science fiction-y stuff compared to 200 years ago. However, television has got sort of you've got false fronts, you do have makeup. Also on television, I just sort of think that you don't have as much time, things have to be condensed, you're interrupted for commercials more, the caliber of questions are different. Also, people smile way too much. It's kind of like if you look at the, it's just something that's happened. If you look at the, during the recent election for the president, if you look at the money that was going to come out with GW and with Kerry on it, both of them were smiling like fools. And if you look at any dollar bill or any other form of currency, you've got stern, you know, thinking people. So it's just sort of that kind of hayuk laughter that happens on TV, which you don't get as often on radio, though sometimes I've discovered you do also.
It happens now and then. Hey, I just chuckled. Tell me a little bit about the difference between this as a screenplay and this as a work of literature. How easy would it be to make this a screenplay?
Well, here's the story. In fact, we had a major film director who wanted to direct this. And here's a bit of a story. And I went to London to have a meeting with him. He's an American, okay, but he was in London because that's where we were going to get the money from. And it was very interesting because he told us several things that he didn't want, that he wanted to change in this. And I'm not going to reveal names because he's a very, very, he's a good guy, you know. And it was one of those traumatic meetings in which he said, well, I want to do this, I want to do that. And he was going to, he had seriously misunderstood what we wanted. So I went back to Joaquin and I said, look, Joaquin, you know, we can do the following. And Joaquin at that moment was in dire need of money to be able to write. So, and I don't need it. And he did. And I said, look, Joaquin, we can go ahead and write the screenplay for this guy if you want. But I do want you to know that, you know, that he's going to demand these and these things. What do you think we should do? And he says, I don't want anything to do with him. It was not with him personally, but what we are going to write a screenplay, and we've got a beginnings of a screenplay in relation to that. I'm sure it's going to become a film. I have no doubt whatsoever because it's as cinematic as you can say. But Joaquin preferred his literary, the truth of what we were telling. In other words, you can't do those to our characters.
Is there something about the industry itself? Is there something about the medium film, television, that makes it more difficult to make that kind of trend? In other words, do you have to write for film to make it a good film? Or does literature translate easily?
Well, you know, I mean, we're doing this. This is a novel. And therefore, you know, there's a lot of things to be imagine, but Joaquin and I have completed another screenplay with our brother, his brother,
my brother,
his brother, my son Rodrigo. You know, and so we are in the writing business in that sense, and there are things that you can do with a screenplay without any trouble. You just have to be true to the character. We don't want to sell them. You know, we don't want to do that with such beautiful people.
Ariel and Joaquin Dorfman, thank you very much. The new novel, Burning City, Quail Ridge Books, tonight at 7. That's the State of Things for today. You can send us an email at sot@wunc.org. Support for the State of Things comes from listeners who support North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC. I'm Frank Stachow.